Hello, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to episode 36 on November 13, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. I'm waiting for your other host, Ray Goodwin, to join us in the studio, and here he is, so prompt tonight. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Carolyn. How you doing?
Well, I'm freezing.
Chilly, huh?
Well,
Yeah. And colder where you are than where I am, and here it's 39 already.
Well, it's colder than that. I'm sure it was 37 a couple hours ago. It's it's quite. I had to be outdoors quite a bit today, in town. And my car battery went out on me. It really surprised me. And I was really lucky. Somebody came along and was able to get me going. And anyway, you know, I'm out there in this store parking lot, and the wind is blowing, and we're trying to fix this thing up, and I thought, wow, this is Carolyn, this is not good. You know, you must not be doing proper maintenance. But I was lucky as can be. This particular person walked along there. He really knew what he was doing, and he was kind of like an angel. So what could have been so bad turned out not too bad, and I've got a new battery now. And so, you know, ready for the winter. I think it's going to be a cold one. I really do.
I do, too.
Yeah. Well, we can't be talking about the weather here in Texas, so maybe if we run out of things later on, we can get back on it. It's always fun to talk about the weather. Well, I was going to explain if I had to wait for you, but I didn't, that, you know, we're beginning with May 4th, 1942, and these are the lunch and dinner table talks by the German Führer, which were taken down in shorthand by attorney in aid Henry Picker during this time. So I've got a timeline, too, so I better get on that. I have a lot of timelines for tonight, and they're long, too, but I guess I'll go through them. This one is for May 4th. It's and so much of it is all geared toward the Americans, you know. But U.S. Rear Admiral Frank Jack Fletcher's Task Force 17, makes the first carrier strike of the Battle of the Coral Sea, attacking Japanese naval targets near Tulagi. That might be Tulagi or something like that, but I don't know. If I'm saying something wrong, you can correct me if you know it differently. However, Japanese Rear Admiral Aritomo Goto's covering force has already withdrawn to support the Port Moresby operation according to plan. So the attacking aircraft, mostly from USS Yorktown, find only a few targets and can do little damage. Well, they must have felt foolish. Then this other one is General Stilwell. General Stilwell and his party of 14, mostly Americans, begin their trek to the Indian border in safety. To reach India, they'll not only have to stay ahead of the Japanese, but beat the coming monsoon. That's the difficulties that they're having. That's all of the timeline.
Okay, now, and Carolyn, correct me if I'm wrong here, but on my book here, I have us marked for May the 3rd. The first topic being respect for a dead man's will.
See, I got confused about, I've got another start-stop there. I have two start-stops on here, and I got confused because we didn't do it last week, and I couldn't remember if we did it or not.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
All right. Well, then, good for you, Ray. Good thing you're keeping us straight here. I would have skipped that altogether, I guess. So let's do that, May 3rd.
Okay, May the 3rd, 1942, at dinner. Respect for a dead man's will. The case of Ludendorff. Artistic treasures and the community. Difficulties with the Ministry of Education. Privileges to be respected. The status of Brunswick. Roman schools. Berlin must not monopolize the resources of the Reich. Safeguard the museums of the provinces. Berlin bureaucracy, administration, and decentralization. Berlin is not an artistic city. The choice of Nuremberg. I must insist that there should be no interference with the last will and testament of the individual, provided, of course, that it does not blatantly run counter to the interests of the state or the nation. If the state gets mixed up in interpreting the last wishes of a deceased, it may well find itself more heavily involved than it expected. I realized this when Ludendorff died. He expressly stated in his will that he did not wish to be buried either in the Invaliden Cemetery in Berlin or in the crypt of the Tannenberg Memorial, but at Tutzing. Although this desire was a great disappointment to me, I did not wish to create a precedent, and so I respected the wish of this great soldier. For the same reasons, it's my firm conviction that the property rights held in the name of the people by legally constituted bodies such as municipalities, GAL, and Länder must be unconditionally respected. Any tampering with them would eliminate one of the most vital incentives to human activity and would jeopardize future endeavor. Take, for example, the case of a community which gathers together a collection of artistic works. If, in the absence of title deeds assuring possession to the community as such for all time, some strong man comes along and sells and scatters the treasures in all directions, the effect on the public sense of justice will be appalling, and public bodies which otherwise would spend a portion of their resources on the collection of works of art will certainly refrain from doing so. Unfortunately, our Minister of Education, who is responsible for the cultural life of the country, has little understanding for that sort of thing. He quite lightheartedly suggested to me recently that the Academy of Mines at Leoben should be closed with a view to its subsequent transfer to the future Academy of Technical Sciences at Linz. The good man seems to have given no thought to the fact that his plan would not only bring ruin to the town of Leoben, which is largely dependent on the academy for its prosperity, but also that in and around Linz, mines, which are an elementary essential to the functioning of the academy, are simply non-existent. It is an act of equally crass stupidity on the part of the Ministry of the Interior to suggest from the heights of its bureaucratic detachment that the town of Lindau should be deprived of its status as a county town. Lindau is the cultural center of the Lake Constance district and must remain so. Even a town like Brunswick would be ruined if it were deprived of its status of seat of local government without being given some equivalent distinction. And I have impressed most emphatically on Göring that should anything happen to me, he must on no account allow himself to be persuaded by long-winded arguments to permit any alteration in the present status of that town. The Ministry of the Interior is too systematically hidebound in its outlook. Its jurists overlook the fact that although a town of 25,000 inhabitants may be a simple agricultural center, easily within the direct administrative competence of the central authority, it may equally well be a center of tradition and culture with particular administrative needs of its own, which can satisfactorily be met only by an independent municipal administration. In this respect, too, we can learn a lot from the Romans. They followed the principle of concentration of power in a few hands in a time of crisis, but decentralization of authority in normal times. In the organization and administration of towns, they allowed themselves to be guided by the needs of the moment, without, however, ever losing sight of the political and cultural aspects of the case. We, too, should be well advised to examine most meticulously all relevant factors before we embark on any large measures of regional reform. For this reason, I have, through Reichsleiter Bormann, forbidden until after the war any suppression or fusion of the various districts as they at present exist. I have also taken steps to ensure that Berlin should not take advantage of war conditions and shortages to seize for itself all available building material and the like at the expense of other towns. The bigger a town is, the more it's tempted to play the role of metropolis in every sense of the word and try to grab everything for itself. This is exactly what Vienna did for centuries. It gathered within its walls all the works of art it could lay its hands on, bleeding white the Alpine and Danubian provinces, and leaving them destitute of any sort of cultural or artistic existence. We must see to it that the same thing does not happen at Linz when we put into execution our plans for the development of that city. There is no point, for example, in emptying the museums of Munich in order to fill those of Linz. As a matter of fact, I was a little worried lest this very thing might happen, and it is for this reason that I have started buying in the open market the art treasures that will eventually be destined for the Linz Museum. I do not wish to see the museums of one town flourish at the expense of those of other towns. Suppose we made an exception in the case of Linz and proceeded to pillage all the smaller provincial museums with the object of making one perfect collection at Linz. What would be the result? In the first place, we should offend the legal basis on which the ownership of these works is founded. And then there would be no end to the possibilities. We should, in justice, have to accede to the claims of Liebel, the mayor of Nuremberg, for the return to Nuremberg of all works of art created by the artists of that city. And we should start a scramble for possession of masterpieces which would have neither end nor limits. In any case, it's absurd to say that a work of art must remain in the place of its origin. A masterpiece knows no local boundaries, and wherever it goes, it brings fame and glory both to the artist and to the town which was his home. Mussolini realized this clearly, and it was with this in mind that he made me a present of the famous discus thrower. The greatest danger which confronts our artistic centers is, to my mind, an increase in the bureaucratic control that the Berlin ministries already exercise over them. The Berlin bureaucracy's confused central administration, whose proper task is to indicate broad lines and to intervene when help is required, with a species of Unitarianism which lays a cold and lethal hand on activity throughout the country. The danger is a very real one, because during the last 20 years, the ministerial bureaucracies have grown and expanded exclusively within the orbit of their own circle. Thus, for example, we see a man of extreme mediocrity like Surin promoted to the rank of Undersecretary of State simply because he has served a stated number of years in the Ministry of the Interior, and quite regardless of the fact that in all his activities he has generally done more harm than good. As a counterpoise to the bureaucrats of the administration, we must, therefore, recruit really efficient men in large numbers for the local administrative bodies. Such men, however, must be given the opportunity of approving their mettle in independent administrative jobs. The more decentralized the administration of the Reich becomes, the easier it will be to find efficient people for the key posts of the central organization, endowed with the ability to give the necessary broad instructions and the sense to know when their intervention is really necessary. If we allow the bureaucracies to continue in their present ways, in a few years we shall find that the nation has lost all faith in the administration. Efficient men with both feet planted firmly on the ground will not tolerate that the work they have prepared as, say, mayors during the years of longing and anxious endeavor should be rejected or destroyed by the decision of some miserable little jack in office in Berlin. In any case, when the officials of the central administration do intervene in local affairs, they are very seldom in agreement with the local authorities, who have studied the problem in question on the spot and who know quite well what decision ought to be arrived at. The officials of our ministries are men of petty minds, for they have proceeded step by step from minor pettifogging positions to positions of what to them seems great importance and responsibility, but to men of real ability seem ridiculous. Do you think that a really capable man in the theatrical business, for example, would accept the post of theatrical advisor to the Ministry of Propaganda at the 700 or 800 mark salary which government advisors are paid? These bureaucrats live in the tiny world of their own egoism, and the rest passes them by. When I think of Bayreuth, I am invariably worried by the thought that one day we may have to appeal to the state for financial aid for the maintenance of its cultural institutions and surrender the administrative control of the city into the hands of the ministerial bureaucrats. This is one reason why I am so interested in the two sons of Frau Winifred Wagner. I hope very much that they will prove capable of carrying on their great work of their parents. As long as I live, I shall always do everything in my power to maintain the prestige of Richard Wagner's city. I see no better method of safeguarding cultural centers than to confide them to the safekeeping of the cities which contain them. Brilliant city though Berlin undoubtedly is, I doubt whether we can make of it a metropolis of the arts. As a metropolis of the political and military power, it is ideal, as I realized on occasion of the procession organized for my last birthday. But the atmosphere of Berlin is not the atmosphere of an artistic city. We have no reason for allowing any other town to attain the stature of Berlin. The Reich can be well content with one town of 5 million inhabitants, Berlin, two towns, Vienna and Hamburg, of a couple of millions, and quite a number which approach the million mark. It would be extremely stupid further to enlarge our great cities to canalize all cultural activity toward them. I said one day to Christian Weber that it would be ridiculous to incorporate Starnberg into Munich. To preserve its own character, Munich must remain as it is now. Had I so wished, I could have arranged for the party congress to take place in Munich, but as I wished as many towns as possible, big, medium, and little, to participate and to become centers of German cultural life, I suggested to the party committee that we should choose Nuremberg for our rallies. And our annual gathering there must, I think, give the city for 10 days to the atmosphere of the Olympic Games festivals of ancient days. For the same reasons, I refused to remove the Supreme Court of the Reich from Leipzig. But I welcome the suggestion that a Supreme Tribunal for Administrative Affairs should be set up in Vienna. When the war is over, I must discuss with Himmler the question of our faculties of medicine and of medical research. It is obviously undesirable that the medical profession should be split up into numberless groups, Army Medical Corps, SS Medical Service, private practice, and so on.
Okay. Well, my goodness, that was a lot to read.
Yeah, but, you know, it's all addressed at, once again, culture, and then, of course, his very excellent analysis of bureaucracies and their tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any criticism that Hitler has of bureaucracies in his own National Socialist state at that point, without thinking of exactly the same thing here in the USA. You know, the central controllers, the bureaucratic idiots in Washington, D.C., want to mess their hands in what's going on in Tyler, Texas, or Boise, Idaho, and tell people how to do things and what they should do. And so this is interesting because, you know, Hitler's always pushed off as the dictator, the boss that tells everybody what to do. But when, you know, reading something like this, there are people with jobs doing things that are, you know, out of his realm right now because he is so preoccupied and busy with other problems, but he notices them going on, and he is really, really anti-bureaucracy.
You know, back in the beginning when he was talking about the first city he mentioned was Leoben in Austria, and I just wanted to point out that that city is pronounced Leoben, not Leoben.
Okay.
Yeah, because
okay.
That's the hometown of Willy and Poldi Wenger. cool.
Oh, yeah.
And he always makes sure that that's spelled right and everything. So they care. People from a place care about how it's spelled and pronounced. So I thought
sure.
I'd bring that up. I like this very much, and I like what he says about everything in here. And the reason that one of the reasons I got confused about if we had done this or not is where he says here, I have, through Reich's Leiter Bormann, forbidden until the war any suppression or fusion of various districts as they at present exist. And he's taken steps to ensure that Berlin does not take advantage of war conditions and shortages to seize for itself all available building material and the like. And I thought that was what we had talked about that last week. Something similar to that came up, and I talked about Giesler and Speer and the building material problem. But he's that's when Speer was there, and he was talking to Speer.
Yes.
Now he's repeating it again without Speer, but I think it seems to be important that he mentions Berlin in particular, because that's exactly what Speer was doing, trying to seize all available building materials for himself. And so Hitler had to intervene, but it took a long time because, I don't know, they don't want to offend anybody, even in the National Socialist Party, obviously. So things have to be done delicately and so on. But I thought I had that note there in red, and I thought, well, we already did that, But I was going back and forth last week trying to find where to start, or a few days ago trying to find where to start again. And so I got it wrong. But, well, okay, so you've made some comments there. And he always brings up Bayreuth again and how important it is to him and his interest in the arts and so on. I think there's a lot that's really, I think, important tonight. And I do hope we can get to it. I think we should be able to get to it if I don't go on and on too long. So I already did this timeline for the fourth. So if you're ready for that, we'll just go right on to that.
Yeah, well, let me add that I think we're in good shape as far as covering what we have to do tonight, Carolyn, because, once again, just like last week, towards the end, we come into a section that's 8 pages long.
Right.
And with the amount that we normally cover, we're going to wind up short of time to cover that. And right before that, though, there's several little sections that are very short and all, but I think we'll have enough comments on them, and so that we will, that 8-page section, unless we want to go ahead and attack it, we'll certainly start there next week. But that's just the way this one happened to run.
Well, you're pretty good at making these judgments about it, so if that's the way it is, it's okay with me. So let's get going, because I know some of these are just really short.
Sure.
They have longer timelines than they are.
Okay. 4th of May, 1942, at dinner. Recouping war expenses. Integration of 20 million foreign workers into German industry. No people is ever ruined by its debts. The Fuhrer says, I have already said that the payment of the debts contracted during the war presents no problem. In the first place, the territories which we have conquered by force of arms represent an increase in national wealth, which far exceeds the cost of the war. In the second place, the integration of 20 million foreign workers at cheap rates into the German industrial system represents a saving which, again, is greatly in excess of the debts contracted by the state. A simple calculation, which curiously enough seems to have escaped the notice of the majority of our economic experts, will show the correctness of this contention. The foreign worker earns approximately 1,000 marks a year, in comparison with the average yearly earning of 2,000 marks by German workers. Work out what this comes to in toto, and you will see that the final gain is enormous. In the assessment of the national wealth, I had to explain even to Funk, who after all is economic minister of the Reich, how the standard of living of the German people had been very considerably raised by the system of employing foreign labor which we had introduced. One has only to compare the cost of local labor with that of German labor abroad to see that this must be so. History shows that no country has ever been ruined on account of its debts. You may take it from me that our economists can sleep comfortably and regard the problem of war costs and debts with the utmost optimism. Now, that short section right there says so very much, and the main thing, you know, I noted right at the end there, Carolyn, I wrote down, easily said with confidence by a nation in control of its own money supply. Now, sure, he's talking about wages being different for foreign workers than the German worker. He's talking about an influx of foreign labor helping save, and also the gaining of territories that is going to offset the cost. But when the state has to pay its own bills, you know, borrow money to fight the war, if they're in control of their own money supply, then you bet he can confidently state that we're running up debt fighting this war, but it's not going to sink us. We're going to be able to handle it. And a country in the grips of the international financial power, the usurers, can never say that. They're going to put themselves in a position of eternal debt from here on out.
Yeah, it's going to be easy while the war's going on, and the creditor is going to say, oh, here's some more, here's more money, don't worry, here's more money, and they're going to keep taking it, but then after it's all over, then it starts paying it back, you know,
comes.
And yeah. Well, you know, I thought this was, there was a lot here, too, because in this first paragraph, he ends with saying how right they were to bring in foreign workers. Well, they didn't have much choice, really, but and that they were, in a sense, saving money because the foreign labor was cheaper than the German labor. Of course, by 1942, the Germans' labor force was all fighting the war, practically, except for the older people.
Right.
So they needed to. But I know, you know, it kind of seems to contradict what I've said so many times in the past, and which was the National Socialist policy, you know, in the 30s before there was any war, and the 20s too, as they talked about it, that they didn't want to use foreign labor, and they wanted to. The Germans were working people, and the Germans were going to do the work and could do the work, and they had the Germans, you know, in Germany they had the laboring class, so they didn't call it the class, but, you know, the labor force, and they had the managerial force, and blah, blah, and the landowners, and so on. But everybody worked together, and blah, blah, blah. So that all sounded great to me. When the war came, they did turn to foreign workers. And here he's pointing out, as he seems to like to do, put a good face on things. But I don't mean it as a... in a dishonest way, because he's seeing that this does work out all right for him, and he's kind of putting the best light on it, and saying that the German people have a better standard of living now by employing foreign labor. Well, now they've even got, you know, foreign women working in homes, helping mothers and families, and there's all kinds of foreign labor, which really wasn't foreseen earlier, but due to necessities, you know, some of these things kind of change. But then when he talks about the territories, if Germany had continued to win and took control of all that territory, and they wanted to put Germans out there into that territory, well, then there would have been a lot of foreign labor working for these Germans, who would have been what you might say the elite or whatever of the area, you know, the like the British were, in a sense. So everything would have been different. And that's when you have kind of empire, that's what you have, you know, that's what you do. That's what brings empires down, too. I'll say that. Anyway, it's not the ideal way I would have liked to have seen it, but it's the direction that it finally went in the 40s.
Well, you know, what you said right there is exactly correct, Carolyn, because this was a progressive step-by-step thing, because, as you well know, in the 1920s, when the party was struggling and there was a great unemployment started in Germany and people out of work, and you would never have, you know, as time progressed, and even when the party took power in 1933, the depression in Germany was still quite severe, and you had many people out of work. And the big job was, okay, let's get people to work. And step by step, that progressed to a shockingly point of where there was a labor shortage in Germany, mm-hmm. because there was people were working, there were jobs, industry had taken off, and building of the autobahns, things like this, had put people to work, and there was a definite labor shortage. And of course, then when the war started, you had so much of the labor force of younger men go into the military fighting the war, and then you had women having to do some work, and so foreign labor was indispensable. So it was kind of a step-by-step progressive thing.
You're right, Ray, to have brought up that this started before the war. And it did. It started when Germany became so economically successful. And there was just a regular labor shortage, which was kind of unheard of anywhere else. And so they started wanting, like, Poles or other, neighboring countries to come to work in Germany. And and they did, and then it just kept growing. Okay.
It was just, a step-by-step necessity thing, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. Now, we'll move
now
on
to... To the fifth, I have a timeline.
Good.
It's pretty interesting. There's four items on the fifth. The things are really heating up, it seems like. It's spring 1942. And the British forces begin Operation Ironclad, the invasion of Madagascar, to keep the Vichy French territory from falling to a possible Japanese invasion. Wow. Japan's going to go into Madagascar. Huh? That's the place we wanted to send the Jews. So then the second one is this.
That's right.
The city of Exeter is bombed by the Luftwaffe, another Baedeker raid. Oh, poor, poor Exeter. Those poor cities. They're getting bombed. And then in the Coral Sea, both Japanese and American carrier aircraft spend this day and the following one searching for each other's ships with no success, even though at one point the opposing carrier groups are separated by less than 100 miles of ocean. The Japanese and Americans are looking for one another and for one another's ships. And General Stilwell, he's still working on trying to save him and himself and his men. He abandons his trucks. You know, they're on the way to India trying to beat the monsoon. And now they've abandoned the trucks, which constantly become stuck and are actually impeding progress rather than aiding it. So, but he retains his jeeps, which are doing better than the trucks. And late in the day, his party arrives at Indaw, I-N-D-A-W. Don't know where that is, but well, that's what's going on the 5th of May.
Okay, 5th of May, 1942, midday. Wallonia and northern France are really German provinces. The Fuhrer said jokingly that he had read last night with the greatest interest the book by Petri, lent to him by the journalist Frentz and entitled German National Inheritance in Wallonia and Northern France. He continued, "This work, published in 1937, further strengthens my conviction that Wallonia and northern France are in reality German lands. The abundance of German-sounding name places, the widespread customs of Germanic origin, the forms of idiom which have persisted, all these prove to my mind that these territories have been systematically detached, not to say snatched, from the Germanic territories. If there are territories anywhere which we have every right to reclaim, then it is these."
Huh. No, I like that. I mean, here he's saying, you know, these have been snatched from us. I like that. Not just detached, but even you could say snatched. I imagine he's read all that history, and coming from a pro-German perspective, I'm sure whatever he has come upon with, I would agree with. That this kind of thing was going on, and there are all these German-speaking people there, are German, people of German DNA and heritage and so on. Germanic, he calls it. Whenever they get out of Germany, they use the term Germanic, which is, you know, a good idea. That's how it seems to me. But he says, we have every right to reclaim these. So they're thinking about how, you know, they've been criticized from the start, from 1938, from when they went into Austria.
Right.
You know, they've been criticized as wanting to take other people's territory. So he's just commenting here about, you know, what really he thinks rightfully they could take if they wanted to.
That's right. Carolyn, on this next section that starts, do you have a date there? See, all my book says is May 1942.
Well, I was going to ask you, but I figured that's all. I just have May, too. But I do.
Yeah, okay,
the next one is May 6th. And,
May 5th, so.
Yeah, so this one we just did was May 5th?
Yes, and
So
I'm figuring that this, since that says midday, this is probably supposed to be May the 5th at dinner, but.
Okay, well, let's figure it out.
Because the next one is May the 6th, so.
Yeah, I'll save the 6th timeline for the next one.
Okay. May 1942, we'll just say dinner. Frequent changes in the Duce's entourage. Lack of efficient and trustworthy colleagues. Do not move a man who is doing a good job of work. Balder von Schirach, Axman, Lauterbacher, and Terboven. Lammers, a lawyer with common sense. Importance of efficient collaboration.
Foreman, you know, sometimes I'll just say it may not have been at a mealtime. And he may not have wanted to put down where they were, because there's another one that where they were, he just says they were at over Salzburg or something. You know, sometimes they didn't want to say, maybe. I don't know, but, you know.
Just wasn't that dinner. Evening or whatever. Yeah, that's good observation.
Sometimes.
Bormann remarked that each time the Duce paid us a visit, we found him surrounded by new faces, from which he gathered that the Duce was constantly changing his collaborators. The Führer retorted, if the Duce acts in this manner, then it is undoubtedly because he has no option, for he knows as well as I do that for the execution of a long-term project, one must be able to count on the continuous collaboration of men in key positions. The reasons, as I see them, for these constant changes the Duce makes must be, firstly, that he has not sufficient first-class men at his disposal, and must therefore be constantly weeding out those who do not come up to a standard, and secondly, that the most capable men among the fascists are invariably proposed for nomination as prefects. If they were not, the king, who has the monopoly of nomination, would seize the opportunity of affronting Mussolini by appointing non-fascists. I know only too well how difficult it is to find the right man for the more important posts. One is compelled again and again to appeal to the same individuals. When I came to selecting our commissars for the occupied eastern territories, I kept on coming back to the names of my old Gauleiters. Loge and Cook, for example, leapt straight to my mind. I do my best, however, to keep men in those positions in which they have proved themselves, for thus I ensure a really fruitful collaboration. Bormann is quite right when he says that a temporary job gives no one the chance to show his capabilities. If a Gauleiter has not the assurance of a long term of office, his projects will inevitably suffer, and he will be functioning under a grave handicap. He will, perforce, ask himself a number of questions. What will my successor think of the work I've undertaken? Will he finish the projects I have started? Will he say that I have chosen my construction sites badly, that I have wasted money with no benefit to the community, and so on? Although I have succeeded in finding men for the key posts, the SS, the NSKK, or National Socialist Mechanized Corps, and the RAD, State Labor Service, and in them I have men of the highest capabilities, I have not been able to find the right man to place at the head of the SA. This shows you how rare are men of merit, real merit. As regards the SA, which formed our shock troops before our assumption of power, it has now tended to become a force which often either fails to realize in time which way its duty lies or bungles the execution of it. When I think of this degeneration of the SA, I cannot help but congratulating myself on having found in Chirac the ideal man for the leadership of the National Socialist Youth Movement. To Chirac undoubtedly belongs the credit for having founded and organized on a most solid basis the most important youth movement in the world. Chirac came to me at a very young man, as a very young man, but one who had already distinguished himself among his fellow students. What splendid young men his collaborators and successors are, Axmann and Lauterbacher. I know exactly what Bormann means when he refers to the outstanding work done by Lauterbacher as Gauleiter of Hanover, and I'm glad to be able to agree with him when he expresses appreciation of Lauterbacher as president. Axmann, whom the young people have always regarded as a great idealist, is now more admired than ever by them since he came back from the front so grievously but so gloriously wounded. In the eyes of the Hitler Youth, Axmann is the personification of all the military virtues. In Terboven, I am pleased to have found a man capable of assuming control of Norway, the most difficult commissarship of the Reich. As he himself told me this very day, if he relaxes his authority for a single instant, he feels as though he were standing on quicksands. He was, for instance, compelled to arrest a number of Norwegian teachers who had seen fit to try to sabotage certain measures taken by the German High Command, and he is now employing them in building fortifications. I only regret that the traditional German benevolence of the naval authorities charged with the transportation of these people was once more carried to stupid lengths. The embarkation authorities at first refused to carry these passengers on the grounds that sufficient life belts for them were not available. Surely these Norwegians would have been delighted if they had been torpedoed by their beloved British and sent to the bottom of the sea. Not the least important of the reasons why I have succeeded in filling the key posts with men capable of performing their duties is the fact that they were recruited not on the grounds of having had a juridical training, but because they had successfully passed through the school of life. The only jurist among my collaborators who is worth a damn is Lammers. Lammers knows that he is there to find legal foundations to fit state requirements, and he does not confuse practical necessity and legal theory. In spite of his legal training, he has a deep knowledge of human nature. Without the help of these efficient and enthusiastic colleagues, I should certainly not have achieved the political successes which have fallen to me. To those among them who, in their enthusiasm for the regeneration of our nation, go too far and hail me as a prophet, a second Mohammed, or a second Messiah, I can only retort that I can find no trace of any resemblance in myself to a Messiah. Pretty well said there.
Well, he must be hearing it, you know. He must be hearing people talking about it. And even in the party, people wanted to start doing things that would make him into some kind of a icon or whatever, you know, and build things to him and so on. And he was always discouraging that. And it made him uncomfortable because people, everybody knows they're just a human being, no matter how competent and special they are, you know, and if you're an honest, straightforward person, you're not comfortable with being made into some kind of a potentate with, you know, divine nature or something, right?
You know, as confident as Adolf Hitler was in his abilities and everything, he still had a modicum of modesty about things, and this is an example of it right here. These people trying to make a god out of me and whatever, I can't see any resemblance there. I'm sure he appreciates the adoration, and respect, but he led into that by talking about the best men he had working for him. And
well, that's what it is. What he appreciates most is competence in people and people doing their duty for Germany. and not all the other stuff. You know, that's what he wants.
And doing their jobs where he doesn't have to step in and say, hey, you're bungling this right here. He could hand the jobs off to those fellas and know that it was going to get done and be done correctly.
Well, I like what he said about the youth movement. He gave a lot of praise to Schirach, Walter von Schirach, who stepped down in 1940, I believe it was, in order to take over the leadership of Vienna and whatever, the Reichsleiter or whatever of Vienna, you know. And Arthur Axman took over, and he ran the Hitler Youth from 1940 to 1945. And he just had excellent reviews on that. They say he just did a wonderful job. And Hitler also brings out this person named Lauterbacher, who I also looked up, and he was also very very devoted and very, in a sense you might say, strict about the party. You know, he wasn't one of these easygoing guys, but he was of the highest of the highest moral. Well, not just I don't mean to be making him out to be some kind of a. He just never gave up. And after the war, this Lauterbacher, he got arrested, but then he escaped, and they didn't find him again for quite a few years. And he was busy trying to help the underground and the people getting to Argentina and things like that. I think I don't know, I better not say that. But finally they got him again, and he went on some kind of a trial, and they found him guilty, but they let him go after so many years. He didn't serve out that long sentence they gave him, and but he was always working along the same lines. You know, he wasn't one of those people that just switched and gave up on it. Now, when Hitler says that he was came back from the front so grievously but gloriously wounded, he found out that he lost an arm on the Eastern Front. And then he came back and served with the Hitler Youth, and they all saw him as a big hero. Oh, here's the story of Axman, and Axman was in the Führer bunker at the end, and I remember him being mentioned all the time there, you know, when Hitler committed suicide and before everybody left. And he left the Führer bunker with Bormann and Dr. Stumpfeger. Dr. Stumpfeger was Hitler's personal physician and a doctor down there, you know, for whoever needed it. But these three, they went off in a larger group. But then these three took off on their own because, you know, they didn't, they kind of split up that group that left so they wouldn't be seen and noticed so much. But then Axman parted from Bormann and Stumpfeger at a certain point, and he went in a different direction. And he ran into a Red Army patrol. When he saw them, he doubled back. And when he was going back the other way he had come, he passed the bodies of Bormann and Stumpfeger and said that he later that he recognized their faces in the moonlight. And he knew it was no doubt it was them. And that was the proof for one of them, you know, that Bormann indeed was killed and was dead and not somebody, you know, hiding out forever on the other side of the moon or something.
Right.
So, and then when he talks about Norway, you know, Norway is, I got kind of a kick out of him saying the Norwegians would have been delighted if they had been torpedoed by their beloved British and sent to the bottom of the sea. You know, pointing out that these Norwegians and the Dutch, too, just couldn't get over their attachment to wanting to be on Britain's side. And you know, no matter what the British did to them, what the British were going to do some pretty bad things to Norway, and they were going to occupy Norway themselves. But the Norwegians just, you know, so Hitler's pointing out that it was hard to win over the Norwegians, and they never really did because they were so attached to Britain and the other side. So,
that was extremely unfortunate, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and really never should have been, because they were much closer blood kin to the Germans than they were the damn English. But
that's right. They can't seem to. You know, there's something about those people there in Europe. They just, even though they know, it must be that they're either jealous or they're afraid of Germany. They don't want to be under the thumb of Germany, knowing they know how strong Germany is. So they think that they have a better chance of doing their own thing, their own way, by being attached to the British, and then of course the Americans too. Well, they certainly do can do their own thing their own way, which is not very good for their race. But that's what stood out for me in that part.
Yeah, and you know, quite obviously, all of these fellows that he's mentioning here in such a complimentary way were certainly idealists, but they were loyal, extremely loyal, and I don't mean just to Hitler, but to the tenets of National Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they believed in carrying them out every bit as much as Hitler himself did. And that, to me, you know, that set them apart, and it also was explains why he says men like that are very, very difficult to find.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because, like I say, they were cut above your average Joe, so to speak. And I'm glad to see, you know, his compliments of those fellas and talking about what a great job they have done. So, anyway, loyalty is worth a heck of a lot, especially in that at that particular time.
Well, they were true believers, and a lot of them were, and there are a lot of Gauleiters that were that way too, and just worked very, very hard and very sincerely and seriously to make it all work and to take care of their districts and so on. And yeah, there are a lot of these people. Look at Reinhard Heydrich, who we mentioned last week. A lot of these great National Socialists who were totally turned on by it and believed in it.
That's right. Well, we shall move on to the 6th of May, 1942.
Yeah, and did I have this timeline to give that I didn't
give
before?
Right, yeah.
Okay, the 6th on Corregidor, Lieutenant General Jonathan M. Wainwright surrenders the last U.S. forces in the Philippines to General Masaharu Homma. Oh, I've heard of Homma, H-O-M-M-A. He's a famous general. About 12,000 are made prisoners. Homma will soon face criticism from his superiors over the amount of time it has taken him to reduce the Philippines and be forced into retirement in 1943. They thought he didn't do a good enough job, took him too long. That's what Wikipedia is saying. After a pep talk, and here's the next, back to General Stilwell again. After a pep talk, General Stilwell and his party of 114 set out from Indaw on foot with only 11 jeeps to carry their supplies and any incapacitated to reach the Indian border. He sends a last radio message, which ends, "Catastrophe quite possible." The radio is then destroyed. Well, they're on a life and death mission there, trying to just save their lives and get out of there. And I guess they did succeed.
Right.
Yeah, that's why he's so such a kind of a heroic figure and a folk figure, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that in 2002, I had the good fortune to tour Corregidor and went through the rock, as they call it. And you know, I guess people who are students of World War II know about Iwo Jima and Okinawa and how the Japanese had dug themselves in tunnels into that rock, and no amount of pulverizing by the American Navy or even shore artillery once the American forces landed could dislodge them. And so it was extremely deadly and bloody fighting with tremendous casualties for American forces to take those. Well, that is exactly what Corregidor was, and I went into those caves, and you know, when I'm talking caves, I'm talking about an area where you could drive a half track through. I mean, they were big, and there were still desks like in offices, and you could see where a force that was held up inside there could hold out for, you know, no matter what the bombardment and all. But what happened there was, you know, there were many, many American servicemen there fighting to hold that, and the Japanese were pounding it. But supplies ran low.
Yeah, and food. They run out of food.
Yeah, and they finally were driven from the perimeter of Corregidor back into that big, huge complex in the rock. And medicine was short supply, food was short supply, ammunition. And so on the advice of upper-level military commanders, Wainwright was told to go ahead and surrender, probably save lives. But as it turned out, once he surrendered, the Japanese rousted them out of there and took them across onto the Bataan Peninsula for that Bataan Death March. Probably more of them died on that march than would have died had they fought, you know, on. But that was another thing that surprised me, Carolyn, from the rock itself, from Corregidor across a little stretch of water to the Bataan Peninsula. I mean, I'm a fair swimmer, but I could have swum that. I mean, it was not probably 300 yards, you know, and here I was thinking it's probably half a mile across and everything, but actually over to the Bataan Peninsula was not a far distance. And so the Japanese ferried all their American prisoners across that water onto that peninsula and began that deadly Bataan Death March, which was very tragic for the American serviceman.
Well, but, it shows how surrender is not ever a very good idea.
That's right. Yeah, when you have an enemy.
And that's what Hitler thought, you know.
Yeah, you know, that feels he's been insulted and wants to show you.
Surrendered people are never treated very well, unless in certain circumstances they are, but generally they're not.
Right.
Well.
Yeah. So, anyway, just a little note about Corregidor. I appreciate you mentioning that timeline in there. The 6th of May, 1942, infiltration of the Jews into the press and the film world, their influence on Hugenberg and Rothermere, independence of the National Socialist Press, the financial resources of the party, how Schwarz got money, organization of the Volkischer Beobachter, Amon, a shrewd businessman.
Yeah, and you know,
according
he's talked about this before, but
he's
going over it again. So I think this is one of his favorite stories.
Yeah.
According to
a communique from Ankara, the Turkish Information Agency is stated to have dismissed a considerable number of Jews from its employment. The Fuhrer remarked that public opinion was formed by the Jews in all the countries actually at war with Germany, and that this had been the case in Germany, too, even in the days of the Weimar Republic. He continued, from time immemorial, the Jews have always succeeded in insinuating themselves into positions from which it was possible to influence public opinion. They hold, for example, many key positions, both in the press and in the cinema industry, but they are not content to exercise a direct open influence. They know that they will attain their ends more expeditiously if they bring their influence to bear through the so-called agencies and by other devious methods. The most dangerous weapon is the Jewish Advertising Agency, for by cutting off advertising revenue, they can reduce even the greatest newspapers to the verge of ruin. I myself found it singularly significant to see both Hugenberg and Lord Rothermere were compelled to abandon their attempts to support a reasoned national policy because the Jews threatened to cut off their advertising revenue. Lord Rothermere, who at the time had just published two articles in support of the Mosley movement, himself described to me at the Berghof how the Jews went to work, and how it was quite impossible at short notice to take any effective countermeasures. It has been from the beginning one of my most potent sources of strength that I made all the newspapers of the NASDAQ, unlike all the other newspapers of similar importance, completely independent of the Jewish advertising agencies and thus impervious to economic pressure of this nature. This happy success with the press of the party encouraged me to set about making the whole party in every branch of its activities economically impregnable. I was all the more readily able to accomplish this as I found in the person of Schwarz, then treasurer of the Reich, a colleague so skilled in the management of the revenues of the party derived from subscriptions, collections, and the like, that our movement was able to launch the decisive campaign of 1932 from its own financial resources. Apart from Muchman, it was Dr. Lay. Is that Lay, Carol?
Lay.
Who collected the most money for the party. By describing me as a genuine monster, he made the industrialists and their ladies so curious to see me that they were willing to pay anything up to 200 marks for a seat at one of my meetings. Unfortunately, a great deal of the money thus collected was later lost in Lay's subsequent activities in the newspaper industry, for he failed to realize that the printing presses owned by the party were bringing ruin to the newspapers of the party. For all our propaganda tours, the party-owned presses had to print all the pamphlets without any guarantee of expenses. A man like Mueller, who ran the printing presses for the Bolkischer Beobachter in his own name and for his own profit, was never victimized in this way. He would only accept orders for pamphlets against cash payment, and he always refused any dubious orders by saying that his workmen fed themselves not on political convictions, but on the pay he gave them. Our local chiefs, on the other hand, went on the theory that idealism should replace payment as far as the party printing presses were concerned, a theory so economically unsound that it threatened to ruin the presses in question. The fact that I was able to keep the Volkischer Beobachter on its feet throughout the period of our struggle, and in spite of the three failures it had suffered before I took it over, I owe first and foremost to the collaboration of Reichsleiter Amon. He, as an intelligent businessman, refused to accept responsibility for the foreign enterprise if it did not possess the economic prerequisites of potential success. Thanks to this rule of his, the publishing firm of Eher, the proprietors of the Bolkischer Beobachter, developed into one of the most powerful newspaper trusts in the world, beside which the American press lords appeared like pygmies. This success is all the more remarkable when one realizes that when I took it over, the Bolkischer Beobachter had no more than 7,000 subscribers, not a single advertising contract in its pocket, and not a penny in the till for the purchase of the paper it was printed on. If I had not had all these worries with the party press, I should probably have remained ignorant of business methods, but this experience was a good school. My most tragic moment was in 1932, when I had to sign all sorts of contracts in order to finance our electoral campaign. I signed these contracts in the name of the party, but all the time with the feeling that if we did not win, all would be lost, all would be forever lost. In the same way, I today sign contracts in the name of the Reich, quite confident in our ultimate success, but equally conscious of the fact that if the war is lost, then the German people is inevitably and irretrievably lost with it. No expense, therefore, is too great, provided that it contributes to the assurance of our final victory.
I thought that ending told us a lot because, you know, we've talked about earlier when he was saying that no debt is too great and whatever, and you shouldn't worry about your debts. And you're explaining, you know, what was behind that and all. But here he is saying that not just deaths, but that if we lose the war, we're going to lose everything, and therefore no expense is too great if it contributes to our final victory. And so he was saying, right here, he's saying that victory is absolutely necessary, and we cannot accept non-victory. And he was trying to, when people say he was trying to he was trying to negotiate or treaties or surrender and so on with the Allies, he was trying to come to something that Germany could accept, but he would never, ever accept unconditional surrender or surrender like that, because he knew what it meant. So,
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, the very first part of that really hit home with me, Carolyn, about the Jews influencing public opinion through advertising. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I'm very proud that I stress in my classes when I was teaching history at the local college. Naive as people are in this country today, they think they have a free press or free media and whatever. And I would tell them in my lectures that there was a time when subscription prices or people just walking up and buying a newspaper paid the expenses of operating that paper. But once advertising came in, it started to pay the bills. Profits grew, so the advertising grew, and there went your free press. And they mm-hmm. said, well, why would that happen? How could that happen? And I said, well, I had experienced personal happenings on that level that I knew for real. And I had a very dear friend that worked for our local newspaper. He told me a number of years before I started teaching that their biggest advertiser at our local paper was Jewish, had a chain of furniture stores. And our local paper would run a letters to the editor column, as most of them do, and they happened to print one or two letters in there that were critical of Israel and its influence on our government. And I think one of them even mentioned the USS Liberty. And for a change, neither one of those letters were from me, but this fellow that worked at the newspaper told me in confidence about a week later that the Jewish, two or three of the Jews that headed that big chain of stores came to the editor in a private meeting in his office with a couple of other editors and people in there and told him that how much does our $500,000 a year advertising contract mean to you? Mm-hmm. If you print any more letters like that, critical of Israel or anti-Semitic in nature, as these were, and that's what the Jews call them, then we will pull our $500,000 a year advertising contract and take it to Corpus Christi or San Antonio. And hand over foot apologies. Well, we're quite sorry. We didn't realize you had hurt feelings, that these letters were anti-Semitic, and you can bet you won't see any more in there. And that's exactly how they run the show and how they form people's opinions for them. Is exactly what Hitler says here, influence public opinion. That's how it's done. Something that simple, that local, and personally, like I say, I knew that it happened, and that's just the way it is. That's how it goes. And you have
it is through the advertising that they control the newspapers. It's mm-hmm. there's no other way. That's how they do it, and it's been known
yep.
for a long, long time. But when you see it happening in your own local community, like you're talking about, it really comes home. You know, that's
yes.
it really means more when you see it like that, and you say, "Gee whiz," you know, and that's just how fast they go along with it too. Now, what if in the International Jew, they talked about that a lot. Ford did, and some people who stood up to him. But what if your town, since that was the town paper, said, didn't go along with them? It said, okay, And would they really have taken their, not advertised there anymore if it helped their business and they had stores there? You know, would they really have done that? You don't know. You have to take a chance on it. But nobody takes a chance. They just cave in because that's the easier way to do it.
Well, sure. And in this particular instance, they did have stores in those other cities. And so, but our local paper had happened to put in a brand new state-of-the-art printing press about 3 or 4 months before, and the clarity in the color printing was absolutely astonishing, a big step forward from where it had been. And the printed color circulars or little magazines, as I call them, with 10 or 12 pages of sales. And
that's how they were making their money, using that printing press that came for that big press.
Were,
I see. So they are doing all that kind of work for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, we better go on. I've got a timeline for the 7th.
Okay.
I don't know if I should read it all here. It's so long. The Vichy, well, the first part is important. Vichy forces surrender Diego Suarez, the most important port in Madagascar, to British forces involved in Operation Ironclad, well, in Vichy, France. However, the Vichy forces are able to withdraw in good order. And then in the Coral Sea, the Japanese search planes spot a refueling ship, USS Neosho, and destroyer USS Sims, which have retired from Fletcher's Task Force 17. In what should have been safer waters to refuel Sims, they are mistaken. Why do they write all this? How important is this? I'm going to try to just come to the bottom part. By chance, though, planes from USS Lexington and USS Yorktown stumble across the light carrier Shoho, must be Japanese, while pursuing the false lead and sink her, leading to the first use in the American Navy of the signal Scratch One Flat Top. That's a saying. Admiral Inouye is so alarmed by the loss of Shoho, he hauls the Port Moresby invasion group north of the Louisiades until the American carriers can be found and destroyed. Well, some big stuff going on there. They just love this Pacific stuff on this Wikipedia timeline. In Burma, General Stilwell must abandon his jeeps now. From here on, all the party will have to march. The 59 that carry all their supplies, I guess. The 59-year-old general decides a cadence of 105 beats per minute will best match the disparate abilities of his party, and they march 50 minutes and rest 10 minutes each hour. So he's got some older people there and, you know, maybe injured people and so on. And,
sure.
But it seems like he's doing a good job of leading them, though.
Right.
You have to give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I don't know what this next date is. I did put that timeline there, but I don't I have a Y here for the number.
Yeah, it's the 7th of May, 1942, at dinner.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Loss of the British cruiser Edinburgh, or as the British call it, Edinburgh. British hypocrisy, German respect for the truth. A Reuter telegram has just announced the loss of a British cruiser of 10,000 tons, HMS Edinburgh. I think we can claim to have extorted this bit of information very cleverly from the British. As the commander of the submarine, which was responsible, was not able to see the actual sinking, he contented himself with reporting that the Edinburgh had been hit by a torpedo. Our official communique, therefore, had to be couched in cautious terms. The detailed report left us in little doubt that the vessel had indeed been sunk, and in the subsequent official news bulletins, allusion was occasionally made to the sinking. In this way, we have forced the British to admit their loss. There are two lessons to be learned from this episode. One, Germany is scrupulous about the truth, but she must not be too pedantic where truth is concerned. I am frequently receiving reports from the front to the effect that the troops, reading the cautious and carefully weighed phrases of the official communique, often feel that the full extent of their efforts has not been appreciated at headquarters. Two, Once one is convinced of a fact, be it of a political or a military nature, one must proclaim it throughout the world. This is the only way in which such consummate hypocrites as the British can be made to confess the truth. That's a short little bit there, but it was fascinating or interesting to me because he's talking about the German submarine that hit the Edinburgh with a torpedo. And the commander of the sub had to, you know, he admitted, I didn't see it go down, but I know we hit it. And so the Germans, instead of proclaiming over their media that we sunk a British ship, the Edinburgh, they let it ride. That, you know, they just, and then the British came out and screamed, they sunk the Edinburgh, you know. So they confessed it themselves. And then the British, then the Germans jumped in and started saying, yeah, we took it down. And, you know, so, and he says, you know, you got to be measured when you talk about successes and what you've done here, even though some of the troops at the front, they see the publication, their publicity come out, and they say, hey, we did more than that, and they don't appreciate what we've done. And Hitler realized that they sometimes felt that way, but it was of necessity that it be carried that way in the media until things could be certain.
Right. Right. I thought that was very important. Very important.
Yeah.
You know, actually saying, you know, the British are hypocrites and so on, and he said that Germany is scrupulous about the truth. That was another thing that he recognized, and he believed it. It was real to him. And and people who are fair-minded always will say that Germany was always truthful about its intentions and what it said. It wasn't telling a bunch of lies. But they want to point, they want to make a case where Germany was lying. Any little thing, whatever they can find, like, oh, he said he was finished, he wasn't going to go any further past the Czechs, and then he went and invaded Poland. Well, they actually brought that on, you know. They forced him into doing that. Well, I would like to say here that it's kind of interesting to me that this that the German submarine sunk the Edinburgh, which is a big deal. And it's not in the timeline. It's not in the timeline, but all this other stuff is in the timeline. You know, they never put anything important to what Germany accomplished in the timeline.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, you get the idea that that was all about the things that the Americans did and the English did and the Japanese did, but never anything about what the Germans did.
Right.
Unless it be something like a building, you know, putting people in concentration camps. You know, that's the only thing they're interested in there.
You know, one more note on the sinking of that ship. Just think of it this way, you know, in the way Hitler tells how it was done there and prudence was used. Had that German submarine commander, you know, he knew that his torpedo hit that ship. But as circumstances, either fog or something like that, or maybe a destroyer was after him and they had to submerge and they didn't know if their target went down. But had that German commander of that submarine sent word back to headquarters that we sunk the Edinburgh, and then the Germans came out with this, you know, our sub sunk the British ship, the Edinburgh, and it actually had not sunk, you know, been seriously damaged and all, but didn't sink, how that would have backfired on Germany.
Mm-hmm. And
that's essentially also obviously what he was meaning there. And we're kind of prudent before we make an announcement. And then the British went ahead and made it for him that they had sunk it. So anyway, quite a lesson there, as you said.
Right. Now, we have a couple things on the 8th and something on the 9th that I think we'd like to complete tonight. So I've got this long timeline on the 8th, though, but since you're interested and others probably in the Japanese events and there's more about it here, I'll go ahead and read this timeline for the 8th. In the Coral Sea, each side finally locates the others, you know, they're looking for one another, and they locate the other main carrier groups consisting of Japanese carriers Shokoku and Zuikaku, and American carriers Lexington and Yorktown. Several attacks follow. Only Zukaku, that can't be right, but Zuikaku escapes unscathed. Shokaku has her flight deck bent, requiring 2 months repairs. Lexington is sunk and Yorktown damaged. Fletcher retires. This action closes the battle. While arguably a stalemate or even tactical victory for the Japanese, who have sunk the most tonnage and the only large carrier, the Battle of the Coral Sea is usually seen as a strategic victory for the United States, as Admiral Inouye cancels the Port Moresby operation, the first significant failure of a Japanese strategic operation in the Pacific theater. In addition, Yorktown will be repaired in time to make important contributions at Midway, although she will not survive, whereas neither the damaged Shokaku nor Zuikaku, which, although not directly attacked, has suffered unsustainable losses in aircraft, will be able to refit in time for Midway, giving the Japanese only 4 operable carriers available for that battle. Well, what means more to me is the second item is the Germans take the Kursk Peninsula in the eastern Crimea. That Kursk Peninsula was a big battle. But that's all they say about it.
Yeah, that was the biggest tank battle of the war.
And then they go into all this detail about the, what was it, the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Yes.
But they don't want to say much about the German victory in Kursk.
One thing is that students of World War II can take from what you just read about the Coral Sea and the Japanese commander and then him calling off the Port Moresby attack and invasion. The Americans were quite fortunate that many of the Japanese naval commanders, though very, very able, and they had a couple that didn't fit this mold that were very aggressive, but they were overly cautious and expected the worst, and they let their actions dictate what they do rather than plunging ahead like some of the best of the German or American commanders. And it really cost the Japanese and worked to our favor in the Pacific in our Navy, because the Japanese carrier commanders or naval commanders were ultra cautious. So it wound up costing them a great deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting.
We'll move on to 8th of May, 1942, midday. The role of Crete. No German fleet in the Mediterranean. I did not intend to make Crete into a German strong point. If I did, I should have to keep a German fleet in the Mediterranean, and that would create a perpetual danger of conflict with Turkey. Our retention of Crete in the eyes of the Turks would be merely the opening gambit in a struggle for the control of the Dardanelles. In the circumstances, the most we shall do in Crete after the war will be to maintain a center for our Strength Through Joy organization. Just a small little snippet there, but, it shows that Hitler is aware of the feelings of the Turks and doesn't want to extend himself. There's no reason to do that.
And he's very aware of everything any allies or friendly people are doing and thinking, more than most. Having allies and friends was very important to him, and he tried his best to get them and to keep them. People on who are even just friendly toward Germany and not antagonistic.
Right.
So, yeah.
8th of May, 1942 evening. Secret sessions of the British Parliament. The Führer drew attention to the fact that the British Parliament had already held about 20 secret sessions. He added, "Up to the moment, we have not heard a word about what occurred at these sessions. This is a powerful tribute to the solidarity which unites the British people." So, just a short note there.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about that is that he admires people who stick together and who are loyal to their own kind. He really does.
Yeah.
And that's what he's saying there. And he's pointing out that if he would wish that the Germans could have 20 secret sessions and not a word coming out about it,
It's interesting that he knew about the sessions and the number of them, but not a word about what happened in those sessions.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, okay, we'll move on to the 11th of May, 1942, at dinner. A national sanctuary for our great men, the German sense of family.
Yeah, before you get started here, I'll just mention this one thing. It's a little more about Stilwell, since we're following him. It says on the 9th, he and his party begin crossing the Uyu River. Only four small crafts are available, and the crossing takes the better part of 2 days. Well, that's not so important, but see how they're keeping track of every little thing he did going along the way.
Okay, the 11th of May, 1942, at dinner, a national sanctuary for one of our great men, the German sense of family. It is perfectly natural that a people should have the wish to see the great men of the nation reposing in some sort of national sanctuary. In accordance with the wishes he expressed, Ludendorff has been buried in Tutzing, but I hope that one day his wife will consent to the transfer of his remains to the Soldatenhalle in Berlin. I doubt, though, whether she will give this consent unless she has the assurance that she will be allowed to rest beside him when the time comes. In a like manner, the Hindenburg family have accepted a tomb for the old gentleman in the Tannenberg Monument on condition that a place is reserved there for his wife. These sentiments are in harmony with the German sense of family, and they must be meticulously respected. Meticulously. For many of our great men, their wives have been the ideal companions of their whole lives, their comrades faithful unto death, their unbreakable shield through all vicissitudes, and their inexhaustible sources of strength.
Well, that was really a nice, would you call that, the commendation that he said there, pointing out the wives of these men and how important they were. He said that so very well, almost like he would have spent a day figuring out how to say it perfectly. But he just spoke it out.
Sure, and that little phrase that started, the German sense of family, just nails that to a T.
Mm-hmm.
And
our
final for the night, the 11th of May, 1942, at dinner, production of honey. German apiarists could increase their honey production tenfold. Honey was the principal sweetener of the ancient and Middle Ages and was used even to sweeten wine. The old German drink, meth, which in my youth was sold at all the fairs, also had a honey basis. The first cakes we ever exported were the honey cakes of Nuremberg. And that wraps it up. But that doesn't surprise me that Hitler talked about that, because honey is a natural sweetener or sugar and healthy.
He used honey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I use it. I haven't used sugar in I don't know how many years to count, but, you know, just occasionally in cold weather I'll have some hot tea. I sweeten it with honey.
But he's also talking it's good. He's also talking about economics here, though. So
he says
we should increase our honey production because we could do it, you know, tenfold, and, you know, it'd be good, and it takes the place of sugar. So,
leads to a healthier population, yeah.
So both of these were the 11th of May at dinner, but they're separated. I don't know why that is, but anyway.
It's because they varied so widely on subject.
I think so.
Because one of them was the German sense of family, and then he talks about honey production, so I think that's probably why they separated.
You want to tell everybody good night, Ray, for both of us?
Sure. Appreciate you folks being with us this evening. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion and the reading as much as we have. And we remind you to come back next Thursday, once again at 7 p.m. Central Time, and we will take up another episode of Hitler's Table Talk. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah, and it's a great one, too, next week, so don't miss it.
You bet. Don't miss it.